Hello and welcome to the Feeling Good Podcast. I am your host, Fabrice Nye, and joining me here in the Murrieta Studios is Dr. David Burns. Hi, David.
Hi, Fabrice.
Dr. David Burns has been a pioneer in the development of cognitive therapy, and he is the creator of the new team therapy. He is the author of Feeling Good, which has sold over 5 million copies in the United States and has been translated into over 20 languages. He is an emeritus adjunct clinical professor of psychiatry at the Stanford University School of Medicine. So, David, I think you wanted to do another listener question, and this one is on perfectionism. And
being special.
And being special, yes.
Right.
I know that this is totally foreign to you, but you speak well about it.
One of my favorite topics, actually.
So let me read to you what Zli sent to us. He or she said, in your Feeling Good handbook, you suggested that the reader just allow himself or herself to be an ordinary person. Contrary to your opinion in the book, you're an outstanding therapist in reality. You studied in a world-top college, you're well-educated with a doctorate degree, and successful in your career and your life. How can I believe your claim? I am quite confused.
Right. Well, this is a great one and could be the springboard, actually, for a number of podcasts on the achievement addiction, perfectionism, perceived perfectionism, self-esteem. We can have one on the four paths to self-esteem. These are practical topics having to do with confidence and joy versus depression, but they're also kind of philosophical, spiritual topics as well. And let me just say right off the bat that perfectionism is not the same as the healthy pursuit of excellence. There's nothing wrong with, you know, trying to do a good job or even hoping to do a great job.
Yeah.
But sometimes people can hang themselves up with trying to be perfect, trying to be special, trying to impress other people. And instead of finding joy or intimacy or productivity or connection, you kind of shoot yourself in the foot. I know for me that this has been an issue throughout my life, thinking that somehow I had to be perfect in order to be worthwhile, to be loved, or whatever. And I have a couple of vignettes that might bring that to life a little bit.
Before you move on to the vignette, just to be sure, it sounds to me like the difference between perfectionism and the
healthy pursuit of excellence.
Healthy pursuit of excellence is that the pursuit of excellence is really trying to, in a way, to give to the world, to produce something that is of value, not just to you, but to others.
And to enjoy the creative process.
And yes, so it's about joy.
Yeah.
Where perfectionism is more self-centered. It's about trying to make oneself be a certain way. So it's about identity in a way.
Yeah, and beating up on yourself when you fail and being afraid to fail and that type of thing and putting yourself under pressure. And like in the podcast, I kind of enjoy the podcast because it's fun to hang out with you. We've gotten some critical feedback, you know, that we weren't always on the same page or this or that little technical thing, but I don't really care.
You don't say.
Because it's a joyful process, and I think there's some good happening here. And if we were trying to be perfect, we'd still be polishing up podcast number one, and we wouldn't have gotten up to number 17.
That one is terrible.
Yeah. So, but one, like a personal experience I had, and then I'll give a patient experience that make the same point in a couple different ways. When I was in medical school, they used to have this thing called the Mid-Peninsula Free University here in Palo Alto.
Hmm.
And Rob Crist, a dear friend who's unfortunately passed away a number of years ago, but he was an older fellow who had created this. And it was kind of a cool thing. It was like a university, but anyone can be a student and anyone can be a teacher.
Oh, wow.
And they just would put out this bulletin every 6 months.
Sounds very 60s.
Yeah, it was very sexy. And you could, like, if you wanted to have a teach a class on nude poetry reading. You'd just describe it, okay, and then your address, and people would show up at your house every Thursday at 8 p.m. for nude poetry reading or whatever. It was kind of like a human expansion, yeah, human consciousness expansion,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
thing.
Human and potential, yeah.
Yeah, it was fantastic. There were encounter groups and psychodrama groups and all this fabulous stuff that was going on in the late 60s in that kind of hippie era. Well, once that afternoon, I went to this thing at Rob Christ's house, and mm-hmm, it was going to be Gestalt or something like that.
Yeah.
And there were only about six people that showed up, and it was, you were supposed to act out your dreams or something like that.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so this woman started doing it. It was real cool. And then all of a sudden, the attention focused on me. And
the whole group,
the whole group, they kind of turned on me like, you know, a pack of hungry wolves. And they started ripping me to shreds. And that's what's often happened in these encounter groups. And it was very, very humiliating. And
yeah,
it was about a 3-hour group. And I think I had the last hour and a half of it was just relentlessly being ripped to shreds. And every fault I had was brought out. And
sounds like good exposure to me.
It was powerful exposure. And at the end, then they all jumped up. They were all happy and euphoric, and they went into the kitchen to they had to pick some
and
mushrooms.
And you started thinking about committing suicide?
Yeah. I'm sitting on the floor feeling worthless, and they were cooking up these mushrooms they were going to eat. They wasn't like magic mushrooms, just some ones that they were going to have in the skillet, and they
yeah,
were just... And they were all happy, and I was just sitting there, just looking dejected. And Rob Chris came over, and he put his hand on my shoulder. He says, "David, you look kind of down or unhappy. Is everything okay?" And I said, "Well, to tell you the truth, I'm feeling really awful right now because I've just got ripped to shreds, and I just feel humiliated and ashamed and
yeah,
and kind of horrible." And he said, "Well, David, you know, I want you to know I feel a lot closer to you right now. And I really like you more now than I ever have in the past." He says, "Because sometimes it seems like you're always trying to be perfect. You're always trying to impress people. You're always trying to be special. To tell you the truth, it's kind of a turnoff. And when I see you feeling like this, I just want you to know I just really like you and really feel close to you."
Hmm.
And it was just a shock to the system. I couldn't believe what I was hearing, and that's a kind of a lesson I've had to learn over and over in a deeper and deeper way throughout my life. And what I found is that when I'm not trying to be perfect, not trying to impress people, being vulnerable, being open, it seems to be end up at far greater joy, intimacy, and creativity. I'll give you an
yeah,
example with a patient, and this is a man I wrote about in the introduction, the first chapter, I think, of my book, When Panic Attacks. It's a man who was referred by a colleague, and we'll call him, just make up his name, call him just Mitch, just to give
sure,
him his name, and...
Yeah.
He was, just to disguise things further, he was a California attorney and was one of the top, highly, most successful attorneys in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But he was 63 when he was referred to me, and he had pretty severe depression and anxiety throughout his entire life, ever since childhood. And when he was referred to me, he said that a friend of his had just had a massive heart attack and died, and that that he was concerned that he might suddenly die without having one minute of happiness in his life. And he said he had achieved an enormous success and wealth, but had never been able to find happiness. And it was kind of sad. And he had just completed, when he came to me, 33 years of psychoanalysis. He'd had three complete psychoanalyses from three different psychiatrists.
Wow.
And I said, "Was that helpful to you? What did you find out?" And he said, "Well, they told me that because when I was little, he had a brother who had died in an accident. And he said, the psychoanalyst told me, I probably am blaming myself for that.
Yeah, and which could be true. But...
Well, it wasn't his fault. Okay, I mean, yeah. He was like 18 months old or something.
Okay,
But he said subconsciously he was probably blaming himself, so he felt like a bad person. And that was the cause of his anxiety and depression. And I said, well, did that seem true to you, and was it helpful? He said, I don't know if it was true or not, but they never told me, you know, how I was supposed to get out of it.
Yeah.
And so nothing ever changed. And he said his fear always is I might lose a case in court. And what if I lose a case in court?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I've only lost one case in my entire career. And which is incredible when you think attorneys lose half their cases on average.
Yeah.
And so...
Because they tend to be matched up with fairly, evenly matched attorneys.
Yes, so, yeah. And this guy went up against huge corporations on environmental cases and stuff like that. And he was just felt, he was like a mountain lion in court. Everyone was afraid of him. He never lost. But outside of the court, he was real kind of insecure. And people would take advantage of him. He didn't have a lot of self-confidence. And he was just an unhappy guy. And he told me, I work 7 days a week. I work 18 hours a day. And I say, what if I lose a case in court? What if I lose a case in court? I can't even go on vacation. I gave it up because when I go on vacation, I say, what if I lose a case in court? I bring all my papers with me. I'm still working 18 hours a day. And my wife is at the beach and the kids are at the mm-hmm. beach. But I just can't relax. And so one day I used a technique called the what-if technique. It's one of the uncovering techniques to get at the deeper structures. And so I said, well, Mitch, what if you lost a case in court? What are you the most afraid of? What's the worst that could happen? And he said, well, then people will find out I'm not as smart as they think I am. And then when you do this, and then you ask the question again, and what if that happened?
Yeah.
What then? So you try to get to the core of your...
Yeah, get the worst case scenario.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a helpful technique for anxiety.
Yeah.
And so he said, well, then I'll go bankrupt. People stop referring cases to me.
Yeah.
And then I said, okay. And then what if that happened? What are you the most afraid of? What's the worst that could happen? And he said, well, then my wife will divorce me. She'll stop loving me and divorce me. And then what if that? Well, then my children will stop loving me. And what if? And what if? And in his final scenario, he sees himself as a homeless person living on the streets of San Francisco, begging for money and sleeping on the sidewalks. And then two attorneys that he has beaten in court walk by in their $3,000 suits and say, oh, look, there's Mitch. He used to think he was so great. He's just pathetic now, and that he holds his cup up. Instead of putting some money in it, they kind of kick sand at him and laugh and walk on. And that was his worst fear. Now, when you do this kind of downward arrow technique, you want to say, what is the belief system that's causing him pain? And his belief system is called perceived perfectionism. And perfectionism is, I can't make a mistake or lose in court. You know, failure is unacceptable.
Yeah.
And perceived perfectionism is other people won't love me unless I'm perfect.
So, yeah, I need to be perfect for others as opposed to for myself.
Yeah. But he had them both.
Yeah, both, yeah.
Both going.
Yeah.
Now, when I identify a belief system like that, I use a lot of techniques to try to help the person turn that around. Because when you're working from a cognitive therapy perspective, it's our thoughts create our feelings, our beliefs create our problems. And so you want to change those negative thoughts, change those beliefs. I tried a number of things that didn't work, but the thing that turned out to be really helpful for him is called the experimental technique. Get him to do an experiment to test the validity of what he's telling himself.
Like wear shabby clothes and go beg on the street.
Something like that. Yeah, right, right. But it was a natural experiment that came up because he lost his second case when he was working with me. It was a little thing he took on pro bono to help a friend.
Yeah.
And he lost the case. He deserved to lose it because the fellow was as guilty as sin. But Mitch became panicky. What if the word gets out? People, I can't let anyone know I've lost this case. Mm-hmm. So he was the president at the time of the California Bar Association, and there was a meeting coming up that week. So I said, why don't we do an experiment to test this belief? Why don't you go to the bar and tell 10 colleagues, I just lost a case in court.
Yeah.
And then you can keep a 3x5 card in your pocket and tick off if they respond in a positive, neutral, or negative way.
Yeah.
And then we'll get some data. So we'll do like a scientific experiment and see if it's true that people will turn against you. Well, he was terrified to do this experiment.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And that,
but he did it, right?
Well, yes, he did it because he was desperate, and that also tells us it's a good idea, because if it wasn't scary to him, it wouldn't have any therapeutic benefit, because he's not really confronting the fear. So he came. So he was very reluctant, but he'd been, you know, he had therapy. He'd been trying to find happiness since he was 6 years old. So he was a good egg. He said, I don't want to do this, but I'll do anything. He came back the next week, and he was quite surprised, because half of the attorneys, when he said, you know, I just lost a case in court, he said they appeared not to have heard what I said. And they just went on bragging about themselves the way attorneys do. And I discovered that I'd been involved in the distortion, magnification, minimization, one of the 10 distortions. I was magnifying my importance in the eyes of other people and minimizing the rampant narcissism of American attorneys.
Yeah, right.
And he said it was incredibly relieving to discover that I wasn't nearly as important as I thought I was. The other 5 attorneys, he said, was an even weirder response, because not only were they not critical of me, they said things like, Mitch, it's such a relief to hear that you can also, someone as great as you, can lose the occasional case in court, and I just want you to know I feel so much closer to you, and could I tell you about all the cases I've been losing lately and get your input? And could I maybe tell you about my wife who's divorcing me? And
yeah, once you start opening yourself to people, then they open themselves to you. Yeah.
Exactly. And he said it was like I had something to give for the first time.
Yeah.
And he said it's so interesting to me that I finally found joy. I finally found intimacy. And the thing that I had been trying to hide about myself was that inside I feel bad, I feel inadequate, and feel worthless. And I've been trying to fool people and present this false front and wearing my own $3,000 suits and being the head of the Bar Association, having one of the top practices in the United States. That I thought was my strength. But it never brought me what I wanted to bring it. And the side of myself that I've been hiding from everyone, my weakness, my vulnerability, my averageness, my failures, my weakness turned out to be my hidden source of strength. Yeah. And so that's kind of the idea behind, instead of striving for perfectionism, daring to be average, daring to be human, daring to be flawed. It's not our flaws that are ever the problem, but our shame about our flaws and the attempt to cover them up.
And so if you had to explain how the shift happened for him, like what happened in him so that he lost the belief that he needed to be perfect in order to be worthy.
Yeah, or in order to be loved.
Or in order to be loved. Yeah.
He made the same discovery that I had made as a medical student years earlier that.
But worthy or loved? I mean, obviously, because of his interaction, the perceived perfectionism part was sort of deconstructed. But how about the worthiness part? How did that shift for him?
Well, I haven't thought about that. Give me your thoughts.
Well,
let me put it to you like this, and we can do this in a future podcast on self-esteem. You see, when you see he achieved enlightenment, you could say that he had a sudden recovery from five decades of depression and anxiety. And that was his path to enlightenment. We all have a different path.
Yeah.
When you get there, everything kind of implodes and turns inside out and upside down, and you see the world radically differently. But you see, the goal is not to achieve worthiness, but to realize that even that, like perfectionism, is
right.
Just another scam.
Yeah.
That somehow I have to become this worthy or superior human being, and we're attracted to that in Western civilization, which is based on the Calvinist work ethic, that you are what you do, and if you do great things, you're a great person, and if you're lazy or don't do a lot, then you're a bad person. And what we're really doing is trying to, what I have done is develop paths, tools that people can use to escape from these oppressive traps if they're causing problems
yeah.
for you, and find joy, enlightenment, intimacy, and productivity. But it's not by becoming perfect or becoming special. The answer is really quite different from that.
I think that this is a really big topic, and I can foresee a number of podcasts on this.
Yeah,
so
called Secrets of Self-Esteem.
Well,
know.
Sort of like that. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. And how can you have self-esteem and be flawed at the same time?
Yeah, and also we can have a future podcast entitled Self-Esteem. What is it? How do I get it? And how do I get rid of it once I've done it?
Yes.
How's that?
That sounds like a great one. Well, thank you so much. I think that we have a lot to look forward to. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of the Feeling Good Podcast. For more information, visit Dr. Burns' website at feelinggood.com, where you will find the show notes for this podcast under the blog page, and where you can leave your comments and questions. The website has an abundance of resources for therapists as well as non-therapists, including books, workshops, a list of online training groups around the world, and much more. Theme music is Gypsy Jazz in Paris, 1935, composed and performed by Brett Van Donzel. I am your host, Fabrice Nye, and I invite you to join us next time for another episode of the Feeling Good Podcast.